call this program The Flight of the Oiver. In 1934, as part of the centenary celebrations of the city of Melbourne, the Centenary Air Race was organised. The race was the brainchild of Melbourne-based chocolate manufacturer Sir McPherson Robertson. Sir McPherson Robertson had two aims in mind when he proposed the race. First, and perhaps the most obvious, to commemorate the centenary of Victoria's statehood. And secondly, to demonstrate the feasibility of a scheduled air service between Europe and Australia. Prize money totaling £15,000 was offered by Sir McPherson, and that attracted 64 entrants. A whittling down of the entries to the more serious competitors resulted finally in 20 aircraft taking off from Mildenhall, a military aerodrome outside London, on October the 20th, 1934. One of the most unusual entries was a Douglas DC-2, entered by KLM Royal Dutch Airlines. It was christened the Oiver, which is Dutch for stork. It was the biggest competitor, and the only craft to carry passengers in addition to its crew of four. The DC-2 was the forerunner to the DC-3, many of which are still flying in the world today. KLM wanted to prove that they could serve Australia with a twice-weekly air service, and they were using their brand-new, all-metal, comfortably-equipped DC-2 to make their point. It's a matter of history that half a century ago, the Oiver won the handicap section of the race. 10 years ago, another DC-2, the only one in the world still flying, and manned with a KLM crew, retraced the flight of the first Oiver. We'll tell you more about this recreation of the flight in another program in this series, but for the moment, let's return to the original air race. Favourites to win the speed section were two de Havilland Comets, racing planes specially designed for the event. One of the Comets was flown by Jim and Amy Mollison. Jim Mollison was an Australian pilot who had flown commercially for Kingsford Smith's ill-fated Australian National Airways. His wife Amy was Amy Johnson, who in May 1930 had become the first woman to fly solo from England to Australia, flying a de Havilland Gypsy Moth. The other Comet was flown by English aviators Scott and Campbell Black. On the 21st of October 1934, a day after the race began, and enthusiastic Sir McPherson Robertson was in the Australian Broadcasting Commission studios in Melbourne.
We have in the studio tonight an honoured guest, Sir McPherson Robertson, through whose generosity and public spirit the great air race now in progress from London to Melbourne was made possible. It is singularly appropriate that while the competitors are on their way to Australia, he should be here to say something about the contest. We are proud to have this opportunity of bringing him to the microphone. Ladies and gentlemen, Sir McPherson Robertson.
Re the Centenary International Air Race. Dear friends, early yesterday morning, before the sun had peeped over the horizon to disperse the mists enshrouding the Mildenhall Aerodrome in Suffolk, the contestants of the Mac Robertson International Air Race were awaiting the signal to start on their epic flight of 11,323 miles. Never in the history of aviation has there been such a lineup of aviators. And never in the history of the world has there been such an aerial contest.
And the Melbourne newspaper, The Argus, said this in its editorial.
In an age of extraordinary mechanical progress, one takes many things for granted. But flight halfway across the world seems too remarkable for analysis. If the present conquest of speed be maintained at its present rate, an air journey to England in these days will become commonplace. And Australia, that vast land over the edge of beyond, will become part of a great world.
When the KLM Oiver landed at Baghdad, only 3 hours behind the de Havilland Comets, it was apparent that the huge airliner was a formidable opponent. Despite the Comets' speed, they were uncomfortable and extremely noisy, and the English crews arrived in Baghdad deaf, hungry, and very tired. The Oivis crew and passengers, however, were described by one eyewitness as being as fresh as a daisy. Excitement mounted worldwide as millions of people followed the race on their wireless sets. At Allahabad, Jim and Avi Mollison had to withdraw their Comet from the race because of engine trouble. Tension mounted around the world as Scott and Campbell Black in their Comet and Captain Parmentier in the KLM DC-2 fought out the battle for first place. Between Singapore and Darwin, Scott and Campbell Black suffered a failure in one of the Comet's two engines. They had just made it to Darwin, and at that time the Oiva, not far behind, seemed to have a chance of winning both the speed and handicap sections of the race. But the British Comet flew on, and 63 hours and 23 minutes after takeoff from London, Scott and Campbell Black crossed the finishing line at the Flemington Racecourse to take first honours in the speed section of the race. But at that stage, the airliner Oiva was still not far behind. The people in the small town of Albury on the New South Wales-Victoria border were following the race as closely as everybody else. But on Tuesday, the 23rd of October 1934, they little thought that within a few hours, they were to be part of a drama which has become more famous than the record-breaking race itself. Tuesday, the 23rd of October, was a stormy, lightning-strewn night throughout nearly the whole of eastern Australia. Shortly after leaving the Queensland town of Charleville, on the last leg of the flight to Melbourne, the Oiva lost radio contact. With no radio aids to navigation, the airliner drifted off course. In Melbourne, air race officials were expecting her to arrive about 30 minutes after midnight. And at about 20 minutes to midnight, Albury residents heard a twin-engined plane high overhead travelling towards Melbourne and assumed that the DC-2 was on course to the finishing line. But half an hour later, the people of Albury were surprised to hear the roar of a twin-engined plane circling low in the dense storm clouds over the eastern section of the town. A local newspaper reporter phoned air race officials in Melbourne, who confirmed that the airliner had lost radio contact and was probably in grave danger. Mr. Arthur Newnham, an announcer with a local ABC radio station 2CO, rushed to the studio and broke into the normal program on relay from Melbourne with details of a desperate rescue plan. Ex-Senator Cleaver Bunton of Albury was also on the staff of 2CO at the time.
Arthur Newnham on 2CO, he had the station opened here. The chief engineer in the postal department, he had to get across Bungamma off the creek, which was flooded as a result of the floodings, and it took him some little time. A recommendation was made by the late Alderman Logan that we should set up a runway with the aid of motor headlamps. And actually, before that happened, the chief electrical engineer, Mr. Ferris, Morse coded the word Albury on the town's electricity supply. I understand that was not picked up by the crew, nor were any of the signals which came from the ground in the hope that the crew might pick them up. They were not picked up either.
Actually, Captain Parmentier said later that they had seen the Morse signals, but because of the excessive turbulence in the thunderstorm, they were unable to read them.
At long last, it could be seen that all the traffic was being diverted into that one area.
Approaching Albury from a northerly direction, Parmentier and the crew of the DC-2 saw the feebly lit temporary strip on the racecourse and decided to attempt a landing.
It was a remarkable feat of aviation that the plane got down safely, literally missing trees and stumps by a very small margin. The people who got to the racecourse was remarkable. Not only were cars there in their big numbers, but there was a colossal crowd of people there too. And we had Parmentier on the air minutes after the plane landed in a direct broadcast to Holland. It was fortunate, actually, that the race course was waterlogged as a result of the heavy rain we'd had, saved the plane from overrunning. There's no doubt in the world it would have overrun had it not been waterlogged as it was. I interviewed the wireless operator, Ellie Brugge. He was a giant of a man. The interview was the most emotional that I have ever experienced. Never have I heard a person speak in such glowing terms of a person that Lee Brugge spoke concerning Parmentier. He had conducted what they thought would be their last get-together on the plane, a little religious service, and with tears in his eyes, Lee Brugge was, not only was he emotional, but I've never experienced such a love of man to man that was responsible there. It was absolutely remarkable. He said that there was no doubt that the setting up of the runway with the Ada motor headlamps saved the plane from crashing and indeed saved the life of the crew and their couple of passengers.
Mrs. John Schubert, who now lives at Baden Duda, a few kilometres south of the border city of Wodonga, was a teenager living in Wodonga at the time.
My brother said they want anybody with a car to go to the Albury Racecourse and turn their lights on, form a circle and turn the lights on. So George was always a very adventurous sort of a chap, and he said to my father, well, how about it, Bill, will we go? And Dad said, yes, and my brother said, yes, and I was just about to leave, and they said to me, would you like to come? And I said, would I like to go? To me, that was the most exciting thing that had ever happened. Anyhow, we set off, and we got to the racecourse and got in the circle. I just can't remember how, but there were sort of lots of lights about. But I can remember getting in the circle around the racecourse and the plane coming down. There was a hooray went up. We got out of the car to walk over, and I can, you know, remember all the talk that was going on and the excitement and seeing the crew walking around. And I can remember touching the plane.
I understand that one of the crew had a rather pertinent question when he first opened the door and looked out on the site before him.
Yes, I didn't actually hear him say it, but I believe that when they opened the door and looked out, he said, is this Melbourne? Sure, Melbourne people would be very happy about that 50 years ago.
Cleaver Bunton mentioned that both Parmentier and the radio operator Van Brugge spoke on the radio following their miraculous escape. People around the world were listening, and one of those listeners was a young Dutchman living in Amsterdam called Ben Veen. Mr. Veen has been living in Albury, Wodonga for a number of years now, but he still vividly recalls that broadcast.
Mr. Veen, your story of the Oiva incident in 1934 is a story which comes from a totally different area to the stories that we've been hearing up till now, doesn't it? Because you were on the other side of the world.
Yeah, I was in Holland, yes.
And how did you hear about the drama that was occurring 10,000 or 12,000 miles away in a little place called Albury?
Yeah, well, we were listening into the local wireless, and it was given to us. We were listening to the dramas that happened in the air while the plane was, as we thought, flying over Albury, and we heard about the electrical storm, and we heard about more signs with street lights and cars being asked to go to the race course and making a landing strip for the plane to come down.
How old were you at the time?
I was just 20 years old at that time. As a matter of fact, in Holland, the name of Albury at that time meant more to us than Melbourne and Sydney. We were prepared already. We knew about Melbourne and Sydney. Melbourne, it was the end of the race, but Albury was something entirely new to us, and we had to look at the map to find out where Albury was.
Now, I'm looking and holding in my hand at the moment two envelopes.
My uncle, he was a stamp collector, and he sent those two letters on the Iver. One was addressed to himself, being cancelled over here in Australia, and putting the date of arrival on it, the 24th of October 1934. And the other envelope is addressed to the MacRobertson organisers of the race. Again, this stamp has been cancelled on the 24th of October 1934, and they were then sent back to my uncle.
Well, that's just part of the story of the flight of the Oiva. We'll continue the story in our next This Australia programme, but right now, to conclude this programme, here is a portion of the Flying Dutchman March, which was written to commemorate those dramatic events 60 years ago.